it's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying, there is no running, there is no hiding, there's only fighting or dying.
It's Going Down is a digital community center from anarchist, anti-fascist, autonomous, anti-capitalist, and anti-colonial movements. Our mission is to provide an autonomous and resilient platform to publicize and promote revolutionary theory and action.
Go to itsgoingdown.org for daily updates. Check out our online store for ways to donate, and rate and follow us on iTunes if you like this podcast.
My name is Yannick Giovanni Marshall. I think I'm describing myself now as just a writer in Black studies. And so in the tradition of Black writers that have kind of wore many hats, poetry, editorials, op-ed writing, essays, scholarly research, plays, fictions, stuff like that, I try to do the same thing. So I think of myself at least. Those are the posters on my wall, like the Alice Walker and the C.L.R. James. These are the people that I follow. And I'm also officially assistant professor of Africana Studies at Knox College.
Well, on Twitter, among other things, you describe yourself as a Fanonist. I'm just curious if you can kind of lay out for our listeners the importance of Fanon's work and how has it impacted your own writing and ideas.
So I think of Fanon as the preeminent theorist of the settler colony and the colonial situation. So he basically spoke about what the colonized go through, what the colonizers go through. He was a psychoanalyst from Martinique that was embedded with the FLN in Algeria. And so he was part revolutionary, part theorist of the revolution. And he also wrote like Black Skin, White Mask. But his I think the work that has been most influential is The Wretched of the Earth. And that was studying how revolutions happen, how resistance happened, what happens after the revolution, in the colony, etc. And so for me, because I do think that the best descriptor of the United States and a number of other places, it's not so much a country as much as it is a colony. It hasn't really changed from that fundamental colonial situation. It just invited more people into the category of the native or the category of the colonized. And so I follow his directives. I have a few changes depending on the current circumstance that we're living in. But basically, his rule book is a guidelines for thinking about revolution. And it influenced the Black Panthers. It influenced a number of revolutionary organizations. I think it influenced the American Indian movement as well. So yeah, he's basically just like how some Marxists would follow Marx. I think a lot of Black radical thinkers on the settler colony would have some high regard for Fanon.
I'm just curious, you know, how would you describe what's going on in the so-called U.S. over the past couple of weeks in terms of the rebellion? Is this comparable at all to any time in American history? How would you describe what's happening right now?
I'm happy that you call it a rebellion. Like, I feel like I'm a little suspicious when people reduce it to a protest or to protest. Because protests seem to be about a singular issue and that they have like a time limit. They kind of go away in like maybe after 2 or 3 weeks or just 2 or 3 days. But uprisings, revolutions, rebellions, they don't necessarily have a time limit. And so I would think of this as a rebellion or an uprising. But it is, I wouldn't say it's unprecedented in the history of this colony. Because there have been uprisings by Black people dissatisfied with Negrophobic violence, and that would take the form of burning wharves, burning factories, burning plantations, destroying the capital that is produced by their exploited labor, targeting the institutions and the spaces of white power in order to weaken white power's hold over them, and also just for the symbolic or revolutionary catharsis of destroying your owner's power. That was almost the tradition. And that is like the organic tradition. The move to a protest or a civil rights march is a very new phenomenon, and it doesn't have a strong roots to the burning and what people might call riots. And so I think that if we are to think about this moment, we should line it up with the history of enslaved people's rebellions, enslaved people's destruction of property, destruction of white power, and to collectivize their own strength to move against police power, whether that police is the totalitarian system of slavery or police in general. So I would think about it in terms of what they would call the Negro riots, rather than a protest.
Do you feel that there's been a certain set of events that have made this current revolt possible or kick off? Or was this just simply the inevitable, happening of just, the current, situation and just the most recent set of atrocities in this past, month or so?
Yeah, I do think, when I first heard about George Floyd's killing, I thought that this kind of came too close to both the Amy Cooper situation and the Ahmaud Arbery situation, the Ahmaud Arbery killing. And because usually you have maybe one killing and then you give it, it goes out of the news cycle, and then you have the population to grieve, and then you have another killing. But these kind of came together. So I think that influenced people's anger, because we haven't really departed from the situation in Georgia. And then for this to happen right on its heels is kind of what I think turned anger into something else. But the condition of the coronavirus, the condition of not being able to protest as you would like, kind of actually spurred on a different type of anger, a different type of rebellion. It's almost as if they took the lockdown and tried to, while inverting all the systems, inverted the lockdown as well, at the risk of their own lives and the risk of pretty much everywhere. Because death kind of spread like wildfire, or the symbols of death kind of spread like wildfire, and so this also inspired people to get out and to demonstrate and to just be angry. The general condition, because it's not only Amy Cooper and Ahmaud, but it's also just the realization that Black people in any situation, including a pandemic, will be killed much quicker than pretty much everybody else. And so because of that, just the onslaught of and the tangibility of anti-Blackness all around, I think that kind of influenced people to be like, well, this has got to be it. We might as well just do something about this, because this is not working.
People that have been following the rebellion from the start are wondering, how do we go from people cheering a police precinct being burned down to then liberals, progressives, and Democrats suddenly kind of inserting themselves into this and kind of pushing those elements to the side and also attacking them at times? How do you see this process playing out, from Black and brown youth on the ground really leading this moment to kind of liberal activists, managers kind of waving the finger and inserting themselves into leadership?
And here is where I think Fanon is actually just very relevant, because one of the quotes that I tell my students a lot by Fanon, a paraphrase, is that the native intellectual or the colonized intellectual or the colonized bourgeoisie have as their role to be ambiguous on the question of violence. that they are, when the people rise up, when the lumpen proletariat, which is the people that are not workers, but the people that are kicked out of working, the poor, the peasants, etc., when they rise up, it is the duty of the middle class, the colonized intellectual, to kind of step between them and the state and to say, calm down, let's reform, let's ask, let's not burn everything down. And you can see the same thing between the fight, I would call it a fight by now, between the A Can't Wait movement, which is a Campaign Zero movement, which asks for reform and things that can be done to reduce violence, 72% or something, and the A to Abolition, an A to Abolition, which is basically eight steps to kind of undo the entire policing order. And so the A to Abolition is kind of representing the class interests of the lumpen proletariat, where the A Can't Wait would be the colonized bourgeoisie. And so, yes, they have the power, the colonized bourgeoisie, because they are so close to the institutions of white power themselves, even if they profess to be very different from it or angry against it. They are there. They are close to it. They are the professors. They are the teachers. They are the middle class, petty bourgeoisie, whatever they are. They are, they have their class interests and their emotional ties to the state, to the liberal order, even, and what they would like is for it to be improved. And so it is their job, and they've been given the resources and power to be able to speak on behalf of the masses of black people to kind of temper, the rage down and allow it to, work in the interests of the state rather than the interests of the people.
You're just kind of writing off that question the other day. Like, I turned on Netflix and they had a little thing up at the start, like encouraging people to watch documentaries about white supremacy and racism. And a lot of people, especially on the right, have kind of like pointed out, like, oh, look at these different corporations. Look at Nike tweeting Black Lives Matter and stuff like that. I'm just curious, like, what do you make of that? Just kind of like the neoliberal order trying to basically pick up some of the vestiges of the movement and like repeated slogans and stuff like that.
One of the most dangerous parts of the liberal order is to be able to gut the spirit of a revolution and to repackage it, to rebrand it, to make it palatable to white liberal audiences. And so it can gesture towards the rage and the atrocities that have been committed, but not do anything about it, to just produce something else. And when this happens, when the uprising looks like a, we shall overcome, everybody's together, let's march, when they've taken away the danger of an uprising to the order and make that uprising a plea of the supplicant Negro so that they can hope one day that change is going to come. When that happens, when the revolution or the uprising becomes thoroughly domesticated, thoroughly not threatening to the state and to power, then corporations, celebrities, anybody can come in and fasten themselves to it and to say, we need a change, because that change is not going to be a change that is going to upset their power, their money, their resources, or anything like that. That change is going to be a cosmetic change that does nothing to stop what was the original point of the protests, which is to end negrophobic killing, to end anti-black racism in general. And it will just be, okay, we see you, we hear you, let's do something about it, and then move on to something else. So it will be completely diffused. So yes, unless Nike, unless whoever else is doing it is also about burning wards and destroying targets, or fundamentally decommissioning all forms of authoritative power over blackness, then all you will have is a work to sanitize black power movements and to use that black power movement or the black power uprising and change it into something that actually helps police black people. So it's not just that they're diffusing it, but they are transforming it into a baton to hit the to hit the strugglers, and that's what corporations generally do.
For people that support the rebellion, how should they deal with or interact with those that are trying to make really this distinction between so-called peaceful protesters and rioters? Are some people just in a reactionary position and they're not going to budge? Or is there a way to kind of like push a different set of politics and make people move in a certain direction?
I don't know the ways that we could combat just liberal hegemony. Because that's what it is. That's what's making the liberal voice that will be angered at a riot, at destruction of property, seem to take to go to the top, while radical voices that started the protests get pushed to the side. If I knew how to do that, then I would have done it a long time ago. But I would say that it is important to continuously make visible both the history of this and also Ferguson and Baltimore and all these other uprisings as Black radical work, and to continuously call out and show the lines of the capturing of the revolt and putting it in the lap of liberal power. That clear critique is necessary if there's any hope to be able to not allow liberals to blend in and seem like it was always a "we shall overcome" march. The fact that it's, looters are always just, it's always, people are not really concerned about looting. They're not really concerned about rioting. Like, the people that are complaining about looting don't have any stake in the fact that Macy loses, like, I don't know what they lost, like clothes or whatever. And also Macy's doesn't even have too much of a loss, because I'm sure that they're insured as well. So it's, what looting is really to transform Black people that have found a way to radically escape both policing power in their masses, policing power and the power of capital. And to go and to, as they say, loot, but also to move outside of the law, to take these people who are always a threat to the system and to target them and to say that these people should be killed. You can shoot them. You can hurt them. They are the negation of our power, etc., which is in some ways very true, the last part. So yes, what people want to do when they present looters and riots is to just revalorize property and capital over Black life. It's a statement that Black life doesn't matter. Because obviously, every single thing that they called a race riot from the 1900s to like 1969, or before the 1900s, they were basically a white massacres of Black people. So those riots, and even what these riots are supposed to be about, which is the inability for Black life to have some type of value in a settler colonial system, that they are angry at this upset, but they're not angry at colonial exploitation. They're angry at the destruction of property and the lawlessness, the escape from law of the Black people. And so I don't know, for someone that has such a negative view, or would venture out to equate Black life with white property or capitalist property, that they can ever be redeemed to thinking of something else, because they've already started from the position that Black lives matter so little that they would be spending their time concerned about the theft of a shirt or the breaking of a window rather than the ongoing 400-year-long pogrom of Black life. That is a definition of racism and genocidal racism.
Just as a kind of continuation, I mean, also it seems like the discussion of looting isn't even presented as, like, you know, people taking a TV from a Target or something, like, which you pointed out is, you know, it's all insured. It's not like Target is somehow going to go under. But always looting seems to imply, just like in a disaster, it's always sort of implied that these people are going to come to your house and take your stuff because, of course, somebody wants to break into your house and loot your things, like you have all the best stuff to take, which is ludicrous. But, I mean, I think that really plays out, because, like, we've been seeing, like, these literally, like, neo-Nazis online have, like, created fake accounts and, like, perpetuated this idea that Black Lives Matter or Antifa are going to come to small towns and literally kill white suburban people and loot their stuff. And even though it's like well documented, these things are hoaxes, like hundreds of people in small rural towns are showing up armed to defend themselves against riots. And I don't know if you want to speak to that, just this continued fear that someone's going to come to your own house and loot from you, even though there doesn't seem, I mean, there has, that has not been a facet of this rebellion, of course. Yeah. People are obviously taking from places where there are things to take from, which are big stores.
I don't know where he wrote it, but James Baldwin at some point said that, I think might be in his essay on the White Man's Guilt, but that he said that within whiteness, there is a fear that Black people harbor a secret desire to do what happened to them and to do it onto white people. And sometimes when I hear these stories about like Black people are going to be breaking into houses, and I haven't heard that, but I'm not at all surprised. I think what I think about is, again, the uprisings on plantations. The fear that after torturing Black people for their entire lives, that once they break free, that they're not just going to be maroons and to escape into the wilderness and to live their lives outside of the law, but that they will take revenge and to break into the spaces of whiteness and to destroy them. And so it's almost as if they are hearkening back to a plantation mode of consciousness where they actually just assume that, yes, it's logical. If we've been torturing people for the longest time, then why wouldn't they do exactly what uprisings do all over the world, which is to get their uprisers when they had the chance? I would. And so that mentality is probably revealing that on some level, they're always aware of how deep and how terrible the exploitation of white power onto Black lives is. And so their logic presumes that Black people will not be satisfied with escaping that power, but want revenge from it. And so I think, yes, while it isn't the case that Black people just go around and attack white houses, I think what we can read in it is a chance for us to dispense with this idea that white people should be given the benefit of the doubt, the colonizers should be given the benefit of the doubt, that it is not ignorance, it's not naivete that they don't know what is happening. They do know what is happening, and that is why they are scared whenever there is a fissure in the order, because what that means is that they are now under threat and possibility of vengeance might arise. Well, why would they expect vengeance? Because they know that there has been a lot of evils done.
Kind of moving on to a different point. As repression ramps up, how do we encourage people to stand in solidarity with everyone that might be caught up and arrested in the rebellion and support them, even if their charges fall outside of what some might consider, quote, protest?
I think it's important to make sure that the narrative of what is happening does not become the narrative spouted off by liberals and the state so that it would seem like a protest. Because once you start conceding that this is just a protest, and that we're doing this for this and such reason, then anybody that falls under these narrow guidelines will be said to be doing something wrong or excluded. And so you have people being disciplined by the narrative of protest and forcing them into the belief that they're supposed to just follow the rules, march, don't step on the grass, be kind, be nice, etc. And if you don't, then you're excluded. That's how Josh Williams got into prison, because he stepped out of the lines. And so I think what needs to happen, like, I don't really believe that revolutions happen so much as that they are written. People have, the revolutionaries kind of claimed the right to tell the story. Because every revolution against the oppressor would like to call it a crime or like to be called some disobedient. But the revolutions kind of revolutionaries make it into a thing. And so it's still this moment, it's important to make sure that the narrative belongs on the side of the people that have created the revolution, rather than it being given over to liberals and to conservatives and to the state. So that when we say that this is an uprising, then an uprising does not have the same rules and people aren't bound by the same laws as those that feel that they are supposed to be flanked by police officers and walk peacefully and sing songs and hope that things are going to be better. Uprisings have no such limits. Uprisings have as their goal to move against the oppression, to move against necrophobic violence, and that all the rules end there. Where you do not help moving against necrophobic violence, that makes you doing something wrong, nothing else.
Say my name, Bert. Thank you.
I'm walking my cousin to the store, and I just see him on the ground. I'm like, what is going on? I pull my camera out. This man cannot breathe at all. He's like, please, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And they're not here.
You put your knee on my neck, and I can't breathe. My eyes full of sweat and I can't see. My pride to the side, hard on my sleeve. I beg for my life, died in the street. What about them promises I made, but I can't keep them now? What about my family crying tears, we ain't on equal sides? Count up them riots, burning fires, still don't equal life. They done took my life, no peace and quiet, you can't sleep at night. Three police on my back and one just looking. I got handcuffs on my back, say I'm resisting. Got a knee pressed on my neck, I feel constricted. I was begging for my life, no one was listening. As I lay on the concrete, face on the pavement, I was right there in arm's reach, no one to save me. They ain't have to jump on me, they could have tased me. Never thought this landmark was my last location. Fear in my eyes, don't wanna die alone. Tears in my eyes, you hear me crying on. I left the house and I took the back road. I never made it back home.
What happened?
They had the cameras rolling. Yeah. I was begging for my life and they ain't hear me.
Please. Why you couldn't hear me, please?
They had the cameras rolling. I was begging for my life and they ain't
hear me. So you have a series of great articles on Al Jazeera. We'll include a link in the show notes for people to check them out. And one of the pieces that's titled The Racist Piece. One of the things that really struck me was how you point out there's never been a time in which the overall colonial project has not had a legal framework in which to justify black death. For instance, in that essay, you cite a law from 1669 in the so-called Commonwealth of Virginia. This is before, obviously, the U.S. became a country, but it legalized the killing of slaves. And I'm sure most people would agree that fundamentally nothing has really changed from that point in terms of the legal structure, essentially, having a legal mechanism in which black death can always be completely legitimized. And I think a lot of progressives and non-abolitionists would ask, why is this so? Why can't essentially America be able to change? Like, why do we have to get rid of this as opposed to essentially make it work somehow?
I think those people might have fallen for the sleight of hand of states. And what the state would do is to produce a country. So the state gives birth to the country rather than the country give birth to the state. America does not exist. America is a fiction. It is a myth that is produced by the institutions of the state. And so all these thoughts about how America can change kind of presumes that America has some type of spirit or soul, which is, of course, state propaganda, that is able to kind of do something together. Like Rachel Maddow often says things like, what is happening in our country or the soul of our country and these type of things. Well, there's no soul of the country. There's never been any soul of any country. That, if to reflect on it for 1 or 2 minutes, you would realize that that's kind of ridiculous. What happens is that white supremacist power sets up institutions, including the institution of the country, including the institution of the ideological representation of the state, which is the country. And using that and painting it as holy or always waiting to live up to our ideals or having this expanding freedom, all these lies, these things serve in order to put the carrot in front of the donkey so that the state can continuously do what it has been set up to do, which is to maintain white supremacist power. It is clear from the beginnings of this white supremacist power arriving on the shores of Turtle Island, which is of North America. When these people have arrived, it is clear that they have set up organizations and they've set up power and they've fought and they've done what they needed to do to create a space for their community, their whiteness to exist. And then they call it a country. It wasn't that America existed and then it had a problem with white supremacy. White supremacy is not a flaw of America. America is an effect of white supremacy. America is the consequence, or it is the product of white supremacist power, and it is used in order to marshal and to maintain white supremacist power. And so if we think of the product, America, as a product of white supremacist power, then it would be a little ridiculous to think about it being able to change. It's almost as if you're thinking a commercial is going to be radically against the bank that produced it. No, the commercial is an advertisement for the bank, not that the commercial exists and the bank is a problem that the commercial has to deal with.
You know, there's a really a global scope to this rebellion. I mean, there's stuff popping up in many countries in response to what's happened, started in the so-called U.S. I'm just curious, though, what do you think it says about the fact that there have been so many demonstrations, not just in big cities, but all across, you know, small towns and even rural places? I know people have been sharing photos. I think there was, like, some Amish people had a protest even in solidarity with George Floyd. I'm just curious, you know, what do you think it says, if anything, about U.S. society that there has been such a reverberation about this?
Well, the thing about U.S. society is that it, one of its chief exports is anti-blackness. And so it has always been, producing images and videos and ideas about, that paint black people in a negative light. And those, because of its position in the world, that culture of anti-blackness has been, exported. And so people are always aware of that. But now, the evidence of, the reasons for how the Negro came to exist, which are the reasons of anti-blackness. The anti-blackness itself is also being exported. And so, internationally, people are becoming to, all people, like in different places, black people, in different countries and, non-black people are also, being faced or having to confront the reality of anti-blackness, that is American anti-blackness. But obviously, because anti-blackness is a global phenomenon, that the black people in other places also have beefs with the states that they're living in. They're including states in Africa. Anti-blackness doesn't save Africa. The states in Africa very often are just a remixing of the colonial order, and so they're doing the same thing. So the international aspect is explained by, one, anti-blackness being global, and so black people in other places have now taken the power to agitate in this moment and to criticize their states as well. But also, because this idea of black people being free to target in American life has been exported. And now you've seen the contradiction to that, which is the how the target plays out and how visceral its atrocity. Then everywhere else, the same places that have been primed to think about black people as undeserving and inferior are the same people that are seeing how wicked anti-blackness and white supremacy is. And so both of them together kind of inspires people to get out and do something.
You mentioned anti-blackness and white supremacy. Do you see that the two are not interchangeable, that anti-blackness is something on top of the white supremacist way of organizing society, or how would you put that?
I think just as an accident of thinking white people as white and black people as black, the opposites of white and black are also, in settler logic, the opposites of white people and black people. And so, black people have been set up as the opposite of whiteness. And so they become one of the more visible targets. But white supremacy is not only against, black people. It can actually just exist by itself. If there were no black people, it would still be exploiting and attacking and committing genocide slow or fast on its indigenous people, not its indigenous people, but on indigenous people. It will also, even if there were no indigenous people or black people or anybody else, but just white people, white supremacy will still find a way to be able to say, okay, well, this form of whiteness is superior to that form of whiteness, which is what you have in Britain when they're thinking about the criminal as a type of race, white criminal as a type of race. They're doing craniometry and all these things to white people as well, thinking of them and associating them with the colonial people, which are supposed to be inferior. So white supremacy does not require anti-blackness. White supremacy is its own thing. Anti-blackness does not require white supremacy, even though it's very often informed by it. But there's also Arab supremacy, etc., that also influences anti-blackness. So they're two separate. But because they've been set up as opposites, and because the world has been in its central locations, white people oppressing black people, they're basically twins. So you can rarely find one without the other.
Many of the youth who spoke with outlets like Unicorn Ride, who were live streaming in Minneapolis when the rebellion broke out, you know, they were stating their frustration with so-called peaceful methods, and they were articulating that costs, you know, need to be leveled against the system for continuous police killings. And there seemed to be pretty widespread rejection on a gut level of dogmatic nonviolence. And I'm just curious, I mean, do you see a sea change within people? Is this something that you're seeing as well? Or is this something that's, you know, special to this moment, maybe?
I think that people that were under the thumb of white power and white exploitation have always had elements, if not the majority of the people that were there, interested in not just waiting for the oppressor to change their mind or waiting for them to see their nonviolent protest to realize, hey, these people aren't all that bad, and to be good to them. I think a lot of people realize that white power does not exit without a shout. It doesn't just take its leave because it's felt sympathetic. It's not that white racist power does not recognize that black people are human. It's that it doesn't care. And so if it doesn't care, any hope to just hope that they change their mind is just flawed from the get-go. It's required that that things are pushed against. Things happen. The only way that it is that things will change is that it's not no longer in the interest of white power to attack black people. And so, if Target is being painted as a collaborator with white supremacist power, and that does not fly well with its base or its customers, that is more effective than Target saying, you know what, we don't like black people being killed, because black people have been killed for 400 years, and Target or any other corporation did not find it necessary to put a stop to it. And so, push and attack against the vulnerabilities of white power does make change. And this is, again, I harp on it, but it's again why liberals are so dangerous, because they try to pave over that very clear reality and to make it always the case that that black people will somehow one day change is going to come if white people just realize that we're human and that black people deserve to exist. Well, no. Slave masters were very often in very intimate quarters with black people, and that was not enough to convince them. Their humanity was not enough to convince them to get their foot off their neck, as Mr. Sharpton says. And so, yes, people that feel it do not trust whiteness to just get it, because they haven't before, and waiting for it is the same thing, is a very flowery way to say to extend the time of Black people being tortured. Waiting for them to get it is the same thing as saying, let's extend the time for Black people to get hurt, Black people to get injured, Black people to get tortured. And for those that are being tortured, they would rather not spend any more time in that space.
Dear policeman, it's me again, another Black citizen. I wrote this letter a million times. Is the chief getting this? Is anybody seeing this? Does the mayor even read this shit? Scratch that, don't wanna seem like that angry Black man. Listen, we've been peacefully protesting for a while now. We still getting shot down, please tell your homies calm down. We tried to kneel at a game to gain some respect, and they all turn around and kneel on our necks? What's next? You supposed to serve and protect, but I don't feel protected. One of your homies on Facebook used my picture for target practice. How the fuck I'm supposed to feel? Scratch that. There I go, sounding like another angry Black man. Look, I'm trying to keep the peace with you, cause I got a cop for a neighbor, and man, he's pretty cool. Seems like a decent dude.
Does that even matter though?
Well, maybe you two should do lunch. No lie, me and my Black friends are pretty dope. If you got to know us, maybe we could talk about it over coffee and donuts. The world thinks you're a hero, but you gon' have to show us. Cause I done witnessed too much pain, marched with my picket fence through the rain. How many more tears do we gotta cry? How many more times you gon' take our lives? Our lives. Yeah, mama told me God the only one I need to fear. But when I see your red and blue lights in my rear, I say a prayer cause my life could end here. Depending all on how the cop feels. You hate me, I know it, you hate me, I know it. You see my face and you can't wait to reload it. Man, I'm tired and broken, my words go unnoticed. I'm done being frozen. How about I kneel up on your neck until your bitch ass is choking? How about I burn your businesses down and take what you owe us? Bust the windows out of your cars and do it over and over and over and over. Cause y'all killing us over and over. You treat us like prey, this PTSD won't go away. You damn right I'm angry and Black, bitch, you made me this way. Got these children scared to be Black, cause how y'all do us today. Michigan State Capitol, they protesting with guns, and y'all ain't do nothing. And we out here protesting unarmed and still get bombed, and y'all still don't see the prop. It just happens so much, I learned to live with the drama, deal with the trauma. All praises to the high, in the end y'all gon' deal with the karma. I know y'all tired of riots, and I'm tired of writing.
And another article that it was published to Al Jazeera entitled Black Liberal, Your Time Is Up. A really good piece. Again, we'll link that. You know, you kind of take on, again, the liberal establishment. And I'm just curious, you know, right now we've just seen the Democrats do this big photo op. They've put forward this new set of reforms that, of course, I mean, I don't think anybody thinks are actually going to get passed with Republicans in office, and Trump will obviously not sign it. I also just watched today, Joe Biden was on The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, and he was asked, you know, what is your plan for police reform? And it, you know, basically they said nothing. And of course, Joe Biden is, you know, one of the archetypes of, you know, the Biden crime bill and, you know, the drug war, which, you know, of course led to all the stuff that people are revolting in the streets, you know, against today. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, in the spirit of that piece, you know, what is your response basically to the Democrats really kind of jumping in front of this thing and making it appear that they're like really going to do something about police violence in the United States?
I think it's horrific, but it's horrific not just because it's not going to do anything. It's horrific because of what it reveals about how Black people are looked at by liberals, by progressives, by the white left, and left meaning not left as in left, but left as in democratic. What it reveals is that, just like Cory Booker was I think he gave he was testifying for Congress or House or one of those things, right? And he said that, Black people are saying, do you hear me? Black people are saying, America, I love you, do you see me? that is a caricature that you of black people that you would find in like 1900s, 1920s, 1930s movies or 1900s novels and books of the supplicant Negro on their knee begging for white people to be kinder to them, to not to whip them less. That's racism. That is fundamental racism. That is the racism of Prissy in Gone with the Wind, begging Scarlett O'Hara to not send her down the river. That is the picture that these people are sending out. And this is what the Democrats and people like Cory Booker are doing, is they are representing black people like that in order to, and because they think of black people like that, then this is why they are performing, because they think this is going to be satisfactory, to show some type of kneeling and solemnness to be close to blackness. Well, this character can only exist when there has been a washing of black people, black humanity, black thought, black radical thinking. And radical thinking just meaning something outside of what is being the stereotypical black person. That invisibility makes it possible for black people to only be represented as this type of America, I love you, do you see me person. And that invisibility lets people, groups like Democrats and liberals, to not go further than their nonsensical cosmetic reforms, because they do not see, they have not really reconciled themselves with the fact that black people as people actually exist. It's always black people as Prissy, black people as the supplicant Negro. And so I have no hope that Democrats or anybody will actually see the humanity of black people ever until there is a counter to that racist picture of black people that Cory Booker and his ilk would espouse. Like, you don't think of that in terms of like the Arab revolutions or the Vietnamese people or anything. No, there's no Vietnamese supplicant Negro type of character. It's only black people, and that is because the tradition of representing blackness is that of a slave. And this is what, it's not innocent. This is what Cory Booker is playing with, intentioned or not intentioned.
Police and prison abolition is now more front and center than ever before in public discourse, you know, some of it more washed down than others, other variants. For those involved in social movements and struggles, how does this change the terrain that a lot of people are talking about this?
I think it is a success to counter liberal ideology. Liberal ideology has always had the upper hand to be able to go on in the newsrooms, to go on radios, to write articles, to do what they wanted, to be able to say that we need a change or America is failing black people. Well, now you're finding radical voices also appear in the mainstream, not just in our organizations or in our leftist magazines and programs, but we're here, we're outside where people can see us. And we are saying that no, it's not enough to have reforms, because police will reform regardless of whether they're pushed. Their business is to continuously change. There's no such thing as a static institution. Reforms do not add anything. They're saying that abolition is necessary. Remove the possibility for this slave overseer institution to continue, and to destroy all of its elements, not just let some go, not just wait for a less devastating strike of the baton, but remove this culture of having batons in the first place. That is a success. That is literally like when the old school revolutionaries would just do a coup and take over the radio and say, well, this is our time now. That is what has been happening. Black radicals have taken the narrative for a moment in time, hopefully permanently, to say that no, stop all of this nonsense about let's just give $300 million more to policing, or let's have body cameras, even though body cameras exist before. Let's stop all of this tricks and get to the heart of the matter, which is to undo the potential of a state institution to continue its white supremacist governance over black lives. This is black radicals' presence. This is definitional of black radicals having a voice. And that is where I have my hope. Before, we were always invisible. Now we're here, and liberals will have to contest against us rather than having the monopoly of telling the truth, their truth, about blackness.
I think a lot of people are asking, when liberals, especially in social movements or in moments of rebellion, they often self-appoint themselves to leadership and use disarming rhetoric and, you know, put themselves in self-appointed positions of authority. How do people navigate that? How do they push back against that?
I would just continuously look up those black feminist abolitionists. Because they've laid out continuously critique, prediction of what is happening. I think Ruth Gilmore just very recently did something with Intercept somewhere where she had a podcast that was actually laying out the category of crime as that the category of crime needs to be done away with and to think about harm instead. So learning, reading, thinking with black feminist writers that have been on the forefront of abolition is the only way to be able to contest the ideological power, which is basically the mythologizing of liberals, because there is no way that liberals who are the mouthpieces of the state will ever speak clearly. And this is not like, okay, they have an intention to like trick anybody. It's that their class interests have morphed into their imagination, and their imagination only betrays nothing that will be fundamentally upsetting to the order that they owe their existence to. When they say things like hope, I mean, hope, you're talking about disarming rhetoric, hope is something that sounds good. But what they mean by hope is not the revolutionary hope of ending violence. What they mean is to have a expanded purgatory where people will always be living in hope that when something will change one day. So we are trained, instead of those would-be radicals that were saying, well, I don't have hope. Hope is finished. Let's change things now. Let's undo things now. I'm not hoping that there is going to be a reformed or a better day in colonialism. When that is removed, and because people feel disciplined, they say, well, are you against hope? No, I'm not against hope. I for hope, that hope leads them by the bit to the space of not doing anything against white power. And so their hope, their rhetoric of hope and other like words seems good, but it's exactly that thing that is to disarm the uprising. And so the only way to combat that is unless you can actually take the mics from them and to actually have that presence, is to continuously go back to the black feminist writing that would say, like Angela Davis would say, well, this is how prisons operate. This is how police operate. And that thinking will guard against the mythological powers of the liberal establishment.
Going forward, what do you see as the big tasks for supporting the rebellion and just in general?
For me, and this is my bias, because I do think ideology is sometimes even more important than repression. Because a lot of people will be thinking just about the police, as the police in terms of what they physically and materially do. But I think that a lot of concentration has to go to the ideology. And that means to be firm in one's grasp of telling one's own story, getting one's critique to be normalized rather than having the ideological hegemony of the state and being normal. So when people say that the police are good but with a few bad apples, that is a weapon to maintain a harassing organization. What needs to be done is to continuously think that the police do not exist, to say that the police do not exist, to produce the idea that the police do not exist. What exists are people in uniforms, and uniforms only being fabric that is put onto their body, and then to associate that with the state, and then that state having no right that is God-given, but is only instituted by men. And those men are white supremacist men. That state is represented in the police, and that those police then attack people. So it is not that the police are sometimes just like good people or deserve a hero's welcome or all these type of things, but that the state has mythologized the uniform, put it on individuals, and those individuals carry out the dirty work of white supremacist power writ large. The critique of the narrative of the state, the narrative of the country, the narrative of protests, of peace, of good apples, all of these things that are being forced into people's imaginations, that for me is one of the most important parts, so probably the most important part of contesting white supremacist power, is to no longer allow the domination of white power talk, which end up looking like the country, the institutions, and all these type of things, to no longer let that run free without being undercut by a black radical imagination, a radical imagination that does not allow its statements of the good cop to go unchallenged.
We thank you so much for joining us. How can people check out your work and follow what you're doing?
If anybody is interested, then I've just, well, now I think it's 2 years that I've been on Twitter. So I'm at Further Black, at Further Black on Twitter. I haven't really done anything more on social media. And if I don't follow you back on Twitter, then you can go to yadikmarshall.net, and I'd be happy to have any conversation with people there.
Awesome. And we'll add both of those into the show notes. Anything else you want to say?
No. Peace after revolution. Don't believe lies.
This has been the It's Going Down podcast. Check itsgoingdown.org for daily updates, columns, action reports, and news. Go to itsgoingdown.org/shop to support us, and follow us on all social media platforms. IGD, your daily resource for insurgent proletarian life.